So, hi, this is March 7th, 19... Okay, we're going to be serious here. Hi, it's March 7th, 2009. I'm Jan Rigsby speaking from Austin, and this is a teleconference on Patrick Guide Lecture 73, which has the title of The Compulsion to Recreate and Overcome Childhood Hurt. And we're a little along in the tape right now because I've been pressing the wrong buttons, but now, if you'd like to introduce yourselves, I think I've got all the controls correct, and I apologize for the errors. Please go ahead.
This is Catlin in Atlanta.
Welcome. This is Harry in Marshall, Texas.
Welcome, Harry.
It's Randall in Diamond Beach, New South Wales, Australia.
Welcome to you, Randall. Okay, now there will be other people joining us, but this time I disabled the chime so that we won't keep hearing ringing noises throughout the presentation as people go back and forth. So what I'm going to do, and I've said this several times before, a lot of this is repetition, but repetition helps, is this lecture is a key lecture. It's a critical lecture to comprehend the distinction between spiritual work and psychological work. And also it brings in a lot of concepts in the pathwork. And I find it fairly straightforward and easy to read if you have read all 72 before this. And I don't ask people to do that when they join the conferences or when they ask questions or get involved with pathwork. They normally don't read all this material. So what I like to do during these teleconferences is I like to put forward a context so you have a picture of where this lecture fits. So one of the things that I say periodically is for some people the pathwork concepts are a little foreign, they're a little new. And I make this invitation to you. I invite you to try them on. I invite you to spend the time you spend reading a lecture or listening to the tape or getting involved with these materials, during the time period you're doing that, to consider taking an attitude of exploration. Because only reading the materials is not a commitment. You don't have to believe anything. And that's a beautiful phrase that the guide uses in many places. You are not asked to believe these materials. They're put forward because the guide believes they're true, and I like to read them as an invitation to consider that some of the things you're dealing with could be happening from a position, from a perspective that you aren't quite aware of. So I think of it like going to the store and trying things on. It may look good on the rack, but you try it on and it doesn't fit. Every once in a while, it doesn't look good on the rack, but it feels great on you. So please consider just trying these concepts on and really enjoying the process. I talk in terms of games and play because we can get too serious sometimes. These are heavy things that if we take them too heavily, they won't really serve us. The second thing I'd like to bring forward is that spiritual discipline. And the reason that's key is that if you think of spheres within spheres within spheres, human life being the center of our universe, either individually or collectively, because we're human, we see things with human eyes. And it takes a lot of work to imagine a different perspective. So when you're reading the materials and you're thinking, but this or but that, or one of the things that helps me, and this is why I work so hard on context, one of the things that helps me is to say, yes, that's what I feel and that's what I think. Now, what could the guide be saying from a greater viewing position? This is not God speaking in these lectures. These are channeled lectures. And the guide says that he is a spirit, which means he has a perhaps a larger perspective of what's going on than we do. In another place in the lectures, the guide says, you have four or five dimensions. We have 20. Now, I don't know that there is a number, but I remember reading that someplace, so I'll use that number. If we're working in five dimensions, and the spirits in the spirit world are working in 20, they're going to be able to see nuance. They're going to be able to see depth better than we can. Just as if you were looking at something with a black and white camera and trying to figure out what color or shade it was. You can tell what color of gray, but it might be very difficult to really discern the hue of red or the hue of blue. From the earth plane to the spirit plane could be almost like going like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, going from black and white to color in terms of the number of hues of information that are available to you there that we don't have. Now, I'm stressing that because critical in this lecture is the concept that you and I and every other human being on the planet came to this planet from spirit. That's home. And we came from spirit, and we made ourselves to some degree smaller to fit into human bodies and human minds. So to understand, to go backwards and try to understand what this is all about, we need to use our imagination to figure out what could we have been thinking when we came up with these plans. Now, another way to look at that is it's a term that I nicknamed baselining. And you can, the concept in accounting and in a lot of other industries and situations where the question is, where do you start from? So if you were reading financial reports and someone said there's this much out and this much in, well, is that today? Is that this month? Is that this year? Is this 10 years? Is that from the beginning of the operation? And you're going to get a lot of different viewpoints going back along that track. And for instance, today's trend could be down, yesterday's could have been up, a month ago you see a lot of seesawing. You get the idea. It's like looking at a stock market chart and continuing to go backwards in time. You get a smoother line and you get a better sense of where things are going. That's what context can give you. So when you baseline and you talk about a given situation and you say, my foot hurts, that's really not enough information. We need to know when it started hurting. We need to know how badly it hurts. We need to know if you've ever had, just like a doctor diagnosing, how long have you had this condition? When did it start? What degree is the pain? What's your family history? You know, it goes backwards and backwards and backwards. Because you're trying to get a picture of the entire organism. You're trying to get a picture of the entire situation rather than the circumstances of a given moment. I'm going on and on about that because this is very, very valid when it comes to pathwork. So I'm going to switch now and try to talk about the context of the pathwork ideas within the human societal paradigm because they're different. So the phrase I like to use, or the key word for me when I talk about this, is a phrase that I think actually came out of my lips when I was a kid. I believe I might have actually said, if I didn't say it, I thought it, I didn't ask to be born. And in that moment, what I was trying to express was, you dragged me into this mess, it doesn't work, I don't like it, I'm unhappy, and beyond that, there's an idea that if I had invented this mess, I would have structured it differently. Now, that's not just an individual's point of view. That tends to be a societal point of view. Even though we don't say it, we say so many things that reflect it that it becomes a paradigm in our lives. So I sometimes practice writing examples ahead of time, and then they don't work, so I do these things a little ad lib, so I don't have too many at hand, but you might be thinking of some. So any phrase that indicates I am not responsible for this. This is a problem, and it's not my problem. I wonder why life is so hard. If I could do it all over again, I would, and insert the phrase of your choice, I would be taller, I would be prettier, I would be more talented, I would sing, anything that you've thought about your entire life, if I'd been in charge, if I'd made these decisions, I would have done something different. All supposes that you got handed who you are. Now, the massive difference in perspective that Pathwork proposes, and the key lecture on this is Pathwork Guide Lecture 34, which is the, now I've dropped the word, procedure for reincarnation, the process of reincarnation. You get the idea, I've completely dropped the word. But Pathwork Guide Lecture 34 talks about the process of preparation for reincarnation, and it has a lot of information there that might be valuable that I'm referencing right now. What Pathwork says is you did select. You selected everything in your life that is hardwired. I'll explain that in a moment. But you selected it from a place where you had a bigger perspective and a lot of help. So you made choices regarding this life with the assistance of other spiritual people. And the reason you did that as far as in terms of being with a team is that the team had every intention and does travel with you throughout this lifetime. So you're not down here by yourself. You're not alone. There's a plan and there's a team. And I like to think of it in terms of you're the team captain. You've got the ball. They're spirits. They can't move lamps and they can't they're not supposed to make things easy for you. Their job is to support and help accelerate the plan. So what I've just described, it's a shift in paradigm from this was what I wound up with to this is what I decided would be best in terms of raw material. Now, best for what? Once again, the spiritual point of view is that we're down here to accomplish tasks of transformation. That we're here because in the world of illusion, and I did a teleconference previously on unity and duality, in this world of illusion, where we believe that we're mortal, when we believe that we're at risk, when we believe in winning and losing, right and wrong, bad and good, in this environment, distortions in our belief system, places where we do not align with spiritual law, can flourish. So the idea is that from the spirit world, we develop a plan where our distortions will flourish so that we can see them. In effect, what we're doing is an act of faith. We are certain that divine law is correct. We are certain that distortions will never work and that they will cause pain, but we are still clinging to them. So lifetime after lifetime, we come down here to basically wash these distortions out of our spiritual system by truly experiencing what the distortion produces. So that's the task. That's what we're coming here to do. So Lecture 34 gives me a personal picture of a boardroom table and a lot of people sitting around, and I see lots of coffee cups and scrunched up napkins and silly things like that, where you're trying to work out, considering my state of development and what I need to do next, what would be the best possible working environment? And in that process, you are selecting your parent. Now, perhaps you can see where that changes the baseline and the context of this lecture. Copying your parents out of blind, I'd like to be like my dad, is one thing. What the lecture is suggesting is that we have a natural affinity towards our parents because they were selected as ideal foils to accelerate our spiritual path. They're going to help us better than any other choice we could make at that particular time period. So in this proactive place of choosing our parents, we make decisions that affect every single aspect of the rest of our life. By that I mean that when you choose your parents, they're obviously alive and they are living in a certain time period. They're living in a certain culture. They're living in a phase of society, a phase of civilization. Your parents carry baggage from their parents and their all that cultural material that they are carrying, you're going to step into. Your parents are carrying DNA for specific manifestations of human life. They're carrying the tendency for their children to become a certain form. It's tall, short, black, white, more males than females, weak, strong, all these things that a family represents. When you volunteer to be born to that family and you physically go through the process of enmeshing biologically with that family and therefore manifesting yourself as a form, this is what you inherit. So the choice of parents is going to bring a lot of key elements to play in your childhood. Now this goes down to the cellular level. So if you're born to family X that is blonde and light-skinned and very tall, it's not that you can't be born differently. You certainly can. And that may be something that you've pre-planned. But being different from that family is going to get certain responses from the community. You might be treated slightly differently in your family for being the odd one. They may love you and think you're cute, but you're quite different. So there's a place in human psychology where you can pretty much bet that if you come into a family like them or unlike them, into a society where you agree or disagree, flow with or flow against, that there are going to be a natural series of interactions that will begin to build your character and your personality. Sometimes I try to think of this like a billiard table or a pool table, where once the break happens, you can pretty much guarantee the first two or three shots. Like chess, the first move is going to dictate the next few moves. But it gets very, very complicated very, very quickly. And as these circumstances happen, and they're very, very complex, that's where you may be born in a certain given situation that might attract certain attitudes. And this reflects back to lecture 201, which is demagnetizing negative force fields. When you're putting out a certain energy, a family will naturally respond in not the entire gamut of given ways. That's probably not a good sentence, but you may get the idea. So with the psychology of your parents, with the culture and society, with where you are born in the family, whether it's first, second, or 12th, whether the family is rich or poor, whether the family has a history of intelligence and creativity, or whether the family is intellectually challenged. Is the family a minority in their community, or are they in the majority? All of these aspects are the kinds of things that as children and young people, we think that we're just saddled with this stuff. And the perspective I'm inviting you to see is that we chose precisely these elements. And we chose them for a reason. Now, one thing people will say at this point is, what are the reasons? But I can't tell you. Because one of the conditions for this process of using human life to work on our distortions is that we have to forget. So if you can imagine coming down with the manual, just be reading a book while you were driving along or living along. You just, I'm supposed to do this, and yeah, this will fit. And that's not really going to get you to give up distortions that you are clinging to on a spiritual level. In order for you to truly let go of a distortion, of a false belief, of selfishness, of believing that strength is good and weakness is bad, whatever it is that you have, where you are trying to gain an advantage or whatever you're trying to do that is against the spiritual law, you're not going to give up easily. So it is critical that you not know the plan, because you would try to outwit it. That's what we do. If you could have fixed it in the spirit world, you'd come down here with a different task. So there's a de facto here that you weren't able to fix it in the spirit world. You've come here to be in the dark to some degree with a plan that is going to send you down a certain road where your distortions are going to have an excellent chance to manifest and develop. And perhaps you can see where that puts a different spin on the trouble we get to in this life. The trouble we get into in human life, to some degree, and I am not trying to make light of it, because what we're talking about here is human pain and suffering. But to some extent, the pain and suffering we feel has a purpose. And from a spiritual perspective, we felt that this was the best way to enact. I want to put a caveat in here. I am not saying that human suffering is a good thing. I am saying that there are spiritual reasons for it beyond my understanding. And that if we could have learned these spiritual lessons in a kinder, gentler way, we would. And some of us have kind, gentle lives. And some of us have deeply troubled and emotionally or physically violent lives. The truth that I have found when working with people is that everyone has violent emotional lives. They just don't display it very much sometimes. So what I have learned in working with the material and getting rid of some of my own distortions of judgment or thinking that I'm better than somebody else, is realizing that we are all the same, and we all have a task at hand. And as the guide says, it's not my place to judge someone else's task. That your task might look easy to me, but that may be because I've already been there. Or it may be because I'm not ready for that yet. That your task is so mature that you can afford to do it in a quieter, calmer, saner environment than the task that I happen to be handling. So I could go on with that, but I think you've pretty much got the idea. The guide says, do not judge other people. You are exactly where you're supposed to be, doing exactly what you're supposed to be doing with the raw material that you needed. Now, I'm using the phrase raw material because as we build our lives, our free will begins to interact, and we can begin to change a lot of things. But you can't change your gender. And you can't change your height after you've become 18 or 20 years old. And you can't suddenly invent musical talent. You can practice it and become skillful. But the basic quota of musical talent that you've got tends to be pretty much fixed. So this is another point, as I've been talking about what we give ourselves when we make our choices. It helps to think in terms of what we might withhold from ourselves. So if your spiritual task is to go down a road and do certain things, an athletic ability would enable you to bypass that task, perhaps you get born clumsy. If going down a particular road would be easier if you were quick-witted, perhaps you invent a human being for yourself that is more slow-witted. So from this perspective, if you look back and you say these choices had reasons, again, we do not understand the reasons, but they were choices and they were made from a place that is wiser than our human understanding might be able to figure out using the pieces that we have available to us. So once again, using five dimensions, we just can't make the puzzle come together. But if we had 20 dimensions, oh, okay, now I understand. So the lectures are given to us from the perspective of 20 dimensions. Now, that's a long introduction to this lecture, but to me it feels very, very important to do that because, and I'll go into this in a moment, when we talk about parents and children, if we think of it from this different perspective, if we think of it in terms of my parents were chosen by me to help me develop in a certain way so that the rest of my life I am moving in a certain direction with certain attitudes, it shifts some of the pain of childhood and it shifts some of the sense that we did not get what we needed. Because from a spiritual standpoint, that may be true, but it was also necessary. So Barbara Brennan wrote an article for what they do is they syndicate it throughout spiritual magazines. And she wrote beautifully and elegantly of a very simple example. If, for example, a baby's cries for attention are not immediately met, it may suffer a terrible sense of abandonment. That terror may be wired into this young mind and body and become part of its consciousness that never grows up. This undeveloped consciousness is what people often mean when they talk about their inner child. But it's not really an inner child. It's the remnants of consciousness of the child you were that have not grown up. It is your child consciousness that still believes and acts like a child. So unless the belief is addressed, the individual is likely to have issues around abandonment for the rest of its life. So where that fits in with this lecture is that when you choose parents and you see, for instance, that your mother is the mother you want is a good woman, but she tends, when she's nervous or upset, to withdraw, to turn inside. And that can look from another perspective like rejection or like she doesn't want to give. But in truth, she's simply self-caring. She's simply trying to hold a strong container about herself so that she can regenerate love, feelings of tenderness, or the energy that she needs to do what she needs to do. But these are adult psychological explanations. The truth is that a baby who is left alone for hours because the mother is not able to give it the nurturing that it wants and needs may independently make a decision in a part of its mind that is not fully conscious because the baby has no language. The baby may decide, I can't get what I need, and grow up thinking that it's not possible. But a different child, starting with a different task, might think, I need to try harder. I need to scream and shout. I need to be funny. I need to be more interesting. I need to be more so I can get what I need. Both babies may have felt that sense of not getting what they needed, but they would go in different directions even with the same parent, and that's why siblings can have the same parents and go off on multiple different directions that seem to make no sense, because the child itself, the spirit itself with the task, is actually in control of how it's going to interpret whatever comes at it. But the raw material, whether the mother over-mothers and smothers or walks away, or heaven help us all if the mother appears to be perfect at all times. Now, in my family, I had a lot on my one side of my family. I had a lot of very strong, very upstanding, very moral people that looked perfect to me. And I actually remember thinking when I was about 12 years old, I'm in deep trouble because I don't fit. I'm not that good. Now, and somebody else might approach that situation and say, hooray, I have a wonderful, nurturing, caring environment. Well, that's their attitude. Mine was that my doubts, my questions, my concerns, and my impulses had no place to go in that family. So perhaps you can see where whatever a family is going to resonate in different ways depending on which direction you're coming from and the interpretations you make. So again, I'm working on context to put this lecture in. Because when we talk about, well, why would someone want, what, I'm going to back off for a second. Let's go from the back. Why would someone recreate a childhood hurt? Why would you recreate that? The premise of the lecture is that you recreate it because you weren't able to resolve it from your childhood. There's a place in you that just doesn't feel met, that doesn't feel finished, that feels like you failed or that you aren't good enough or that you were too much. Whatever it is that you feel that came out of your childhood that was not resolved, you're going to carry with you along the rest of your life. And you're going to unconsciously be looking for situations where you could either prove that you've changed or have an opportunity to learn and change or prove that that judgment is wrong. It was wrong, it is wrong, it always was, will be wrong. I was always enough, and you were wrong in making me feel or saying to me that I was not enough. So again, if a child, let's go back to the abandonment. If a child feels that it didn't get enough and it won't get enough, then a child might turn into an adult that feels a certain level of despair. Why try? I'm not going to get it. I never got it, I never will get it. And to some extent, children, although they protest things that are uncomfortable, they learn that that home, physical home, emotional home, psychological home, those feelings are familiar to me. I survived them, they didn't kill me, and I know how to handle them. So there can be a natural attraction to the emotional climate that a child grew up with. Whether or not it's dysfunctional, whether or not it's toxic even, whether or not it's good for you, there's a familiarity about it. So those are reasons why we would come to recreate similar situations that we grew up with in our adult lives. So what's the compulsion? And the compulsion is about that positive intention in you that really wants to get it, that's left over from back there, back in the baseline, when you had a task and you need to perform this, that is a driving force on a spiritual level that tells you there's something to do, but it doesn't tell you what. So we invent the reason. We use our powers of creativity, our powers of interpretation. We look around and say, what does all this mean? And we take the information and we put it together as best we can and try to make a life that fulfills us. But the compulsion includes the desire to overcome the distortion. Now, if you notice, I'm not being specific here. And the reason I'm not being specific, and the reason these teleconferences are nice, but they're not really the gut-level work that needs to be done, is that every single person's situation is different. So I can't give specific examples at length, because your situation and mine and his and hers and theirs are all different. I remember in one of the last lectures that I was working with, the questions kept saying, but, just tell me, you know, just tell me what it's like or what to do or isn't this the truth? And the guide's very good at batting that back and saying, you can't make generalizations. Again, I want to draw the distinction there, that in the spirit perspective, in the spiritual perspective, there is no answer. There is no solution. There is no right or wrong. We are the answer. We are the solution. And there is right and wrong. But again, if what we're doing is bringing out a manifestation, like a seed we carry within us, and we're trying to find good earth to plant that seed in so it can flower into, then difficulties in our lives actually offer us our best opportunity to address that distortion. So let me go back and be a bit more specific in terms of the lecture. So the parents have given you genetic material. They've given you a family culture, a village culture, a nation culture, a time reference, what century you're born in, what portion of the segment you're born in, what generation are you, Generation X, Baby Boomer, etc. All that comes naturally to you from the time that you arrived here. And you received influences from your parents and feedback from your parents on who you were before you were completely able to hold those subjective opinions. And all opinions are subjective. Some are based on a lot of objective criteria, but ultimately we pick and choose what we listen to. So you took the feedback that you got from your parents about who you were, and you took it in during a time period where you didn't have a lot of structure in your life independent of your family, so that you could create a context for this. So, for instance, if your parents were saying, oh, what a pretty baby, well, pretty is quite relative. You could be ordinary looking, and if somebody loves you, you're gorgeous. You can be ugly, and if somebody loves you, you're gorgeous. Okay? Now, you may accept that and think that you're very, very attractive and go out in the world saying, I'm attractive. And if the energy in that is clean, then you may get responses from other people that say, yeah, you are. A lot of times people are reacting to our energy rather than an objective set of facts. However, when you go into the modeling agency or the acting audition and you ask for a job, at that point you may come up against societal standards or attractiveness that you don't meet. Now, every once in a while you find a person who's a game changer. They come in and they get the part or become famous, and suddenly we say, we'll include that in our version of attractive. We'll widen our sense of what is attractive to include that person. But for a lot of us, the experience is not good enough. I don't care what your mom told you, you don't sing that well. You don't look that good. You're not what we're looking for. You're not our idea of attractive. So what I'm building here is whatever influences your parents give you, then there's a secondary wave where society gives you feedback also, which may agree with what your parents told you or disagree. And as you walk through all these swinging doors and go down this, I think of it like a pachinko machine, where what happens with a pachinko machine is it's not like pinball. You've got 50 balls that are dumped on you, and all the levers are going, and you're wildly trying to control all these balls to get the best score. But it's impossible. There's too many balls. That's what life can feel like sometimes. So we go through childhood, which is, for most of us, not very controllable. And then we go through puberty, which is also not very controllable. And then we hit our 20s, where we're finally able to go out there and do something, and there's an explosion of energy in the 20s, which is natural and wonderful and great. And then there's the 30s, where there's some stabilization. And what's been true in the past, although as we spiritually grow, perhaps this age will advance forward, this is a place in the 40s where you say, whoops, what was I thinking? Now, on a pop psychology viewpoint, you can then turn to your mate and say, oh my God, I married my mother. Okay? And you may, at that point, make a change. What the lecture is inviting is that may be true. You may have married my mother. I'm trying to translate that into spiritual terms. You may have had a forcing current in you that wanted to complete something with your mother, whether that was about getting acceptance or showing you how good you were or helping her, being supportive to someone. So you had a leftover forcing current from your mom, just taking examples, leftover forcing current from your mom, and you see a person who fits that, they're holding the other half of your forcing current. They're saying, you could do that with me. And so you get together. And it may work for 3 months, and it may work for 30 years. Doesn't really matter. What the lecturer is saying is, ultimately, if you're working with a current that's coming from childhood, ultimately this must fail. And it fails for three reasons. Number one, you can't fix the needs of your childhood by enacting things in a certain way when you're 25, 30, 35 years old, 50, you know, whatever age. Those needs, those unmet needs, those distortions, those forcing currents, those battles that you fought as a child, they're back there. And the person that you're working with is today. So even if you technically, superficially win the battle, it doesn't change the past. And so what happens is we continue. It doesn't make us feel fully satisfied. It will never make us feel fully satisfied. So that's number one, that the problem's in the past, not in the present. And the joke that the image that I use on that is an old vaudeville joke. So in the old vaudeville stage joke, you have a light pole, and you've got a guy down on his hands and knees under the light pole, and the other guy comes in. He says, what are you looking for? He says, I lost a dollar. And the guy says, where'd you lose it? And the man points to the other side of the stage and says, over there. And his friend says, why aren't you looking over there? He says, the light's better over here. To some extent, because we're trying to resolve the situation, we're going to go for, to some degree, of obvious. We're going to try to solve the childhood battles with some similar elements of the battle that we had, which is why you're going to repeat picking one of your parents as an adversary in this situation of resolution. Now, the second problem with that is that the other person is not that parent. They have a whole different criteria. They came from a different family. They may look like, energetically look like, they're ready to meet you there. But they can't. Once again, the battle's in the past. It's with specific individuals. This is a different individual with not only free will, but with a different task than the person that you imagine that you're trying to work out a distortion around. So problem number one is the actual problem was in the past. problem number two is that in the present you're not dealing with that person. Now, even if you dealt today with your parent, they're not the same person they used to be. So not only have you grown up 30-odd years, so have they. And when you try to resolve childhood stuff with someone who's 30 years older and either more mature, wiser, or not interested, or off on another adventure and not too interested in going back to the old stuff, you're not dealing with the actual situation. You are working with a recreation if you're trying to work out that battle in the present day. And the third thing that happens is that you're acting as if I get my way, everything will be okay. When the truth is, from a spiritual perspective, if you got your way, you'd just do it again. Because getting your way is not a alignment with spiritual principles. I'm presuming getting my way is in distortion rather than exercising and developing my ego. But in other words, if I need to get my way to prove I'm a person, one of the ways to deal with this is to take a list of spiritual principles, and there's a quickie list. It's not everything, but it's a useful list of spiritual principles that I use to teach with. It's called PC10. It's on the internet. It comes, it's pulled from a very large number of lectures. But what's nice about that is you can go down that list and say, I need to win. What spiritual law am I breaking? And trust me, you'll find one. In fact, you're going to find you're violating a lot of spiritual laws. If I get my way, violates the law of brotherhood. If I get my... I don't want to go into it, but it violates all of them. It's just a matter of degree.
Jim?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is Lila. I'm sorry, could you repeat what the name of that was?
The name of that is, it's called PC10, which means Pathworker's Contribution Number 10.
Oh.
And it's in the additional materials on the internet,
okay.
The website.
Thank you.
And I hand it out like sticks of chewing gum all the time, because for a one-page document, it's a powerful spiritual experience.
Wow.
And it lists 9, and I tease sometimes that they might have put 10, but they thought, oh, God, that looks like the 10 commandments. They are not laws. They call them principles. And the invitation is to see where your desires conflict with spiritual reality. Spiritual reality meaning we're all one, we're all in this together. I help you, you help me. Getting my way only works when my way assists you in getting your way. But when my way means I'm happy and I don't really care about you, that violates spiritual law. So these principles are useful for highlighting what your distortion might be like. That answer your question?
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So, the first part is that you're bringing this from the past forward, and that's not going to make you feel good. You're never going to resolve that hurt. You may get over it. You may release it. You may heal it. You may lovingly hold it and relax it until it's not an issue. But you can't fix it. It can't be fixed. Okay? Secondly, the person you're enacting with is not the person that created the original hurt. And thirdly, from a spiritual perspective, you're not supposed to fix it. You're supposed to look at it. You're supposed to realize that you're not getting anywhere and sit down and try to find out what is the false belief that I'm working with. Now, from a spiritual perspective, it just sounds a little esoteric. So let's go for abandonment, using the previous example. And before I do that, I'm going to take a short break. And I'm going to change the tape and create a moment of silence so I can snip this in half. So if you'll bear with me 1 second.